during the previous session, and that's really not acceptable. Also, a mobile phone has been misplaced. Apparently it was left in the room after the previous session, so if you picked up a mobile phone, please let me know. We've also got one or two slight changes again to the running order. So after we get news from Joao, Damas and what's been happening in the ISC recently, Ted Lindgren will fill us in on some news on the status of NSD. And after Bill Manning's presentation on his DNS server survey results, Peter's got some other supplementary data about the survey work he's been doing in Germany. So that will take us up and finish up pretty much our agenda. So first item of business is Joao. So over to you.
Okay, where, how do I get the presentation?
Don't know.
Anyone not
signed
the blue sheet?
Okay.
Don't sign twice. Once is sufficient.
Oh, it's this one. Okay, I need a new version of this one.
Okay, then
I have to save a copy and then open it?
Oh, you can just press Control-L.
Control-L? Okay, we got there. So, I'm Joao Damas, I work for SC, and I'm going to spend the next few minutes talking about what we've been up to recently. So the three main subjects will be bind, fruit, and the DNS OAuth. I'll make use of the one last chance to use the old charter of this working group, which used to say that this working group was devoted to discussions about bind versions. Oh, gladly that's now changed. In any case, talking about bind. Bind 9.3 is the main thing, work item that we are dealing with right now. It's the first major revision that has come out in a long, long while. It's not yet out. There are beta versions out. We are currently out with beta 3, which does have a couple of bugs we didn't have time to fix in time for issuing before we issued beta 3. So there will be a beta 4, but it works quite nicely already. And the idea, of course, is to have some field testing. If you follow bind development, we would certainly appreciate any feedback you could give us. So basically, as I say, the thing remaining before we actually do this release is more testing, more widely usage of this code so that we feel confident that it's a solid release. I must also say that not by the name of bind 9.3, we have been using most of these features internally, which makes us quite confident that the code is quite sane. What does it have? It does have DNSSEC-B's support, both in the server and the resolver, with the caveat that since the final specification is not yet published by the IETF. Even though when you compile the code, it has support for it, the configuration file by default makes this functionality, it sets it to off. You actually have to introduce a new configuration option to turn it on. So at least there is some hope that if you do so, you know what you're doing. Another major area of changes in Bind 9.3 is a lot of increased support for how Bind 9 handles IPv6. So there is now a new clause that's preferred glue that lets you tell Bind when it has to return A and quad A glue, which one do you want to go first? The only thing you need to keep in mind here is, of course, there is an IDF recommendation on what to do when you have both types of glue. So it would be really nice if people could stick to it. It basically says that use as many quad A's as you want, but make sure that no matter what, at least people can get one A record so that the internet doesn't split. It has support for dual stack servers. It has all the source address clauses that were in place for before, now also available for v6, so like query source v6, transfer source v6, all the other options. And you can now also specify which specific IPv6 addresses you want the software to bind to. Before, when you turned on IPv6, it was either on all interfaces or none at all. So now you can choose. There's better control of the cache size when you're using Bind as a caching resolver. Before, the option that was there didn't quite do what people expected, and there was a chance that some parts of the cache would keep growing, even though you thought you had limited size, which was not really that good. There's support for the new draft that's out for the identification of servers. We've been using this for a while in our Anycast fruit deployment, but it was only available as an internal patch and for people who asked. Now it's included in the release. There's a new feature that allows you to specify your preferred order for the IR sets that are returned in a query, if you fancy playing with that. There's an option to select which views of the DNS information that the server has you get to see based on the T key that you present to it when you issue the query, not only on which IP address you are coming from. There is better support for incremental file transfer, so now you can do an incremental transfer from differences. You don't have to keep a journal file. It does take memory, of course, to do this. And there is also a clause to limit the size of a journal file if you decide to implement IXFR using journal files. Of course, if you set a limit to the file and then the updates don't go through and the file fails, then you lose updates. But that's obvious. Those were the main things for Bind 9.3. We are still working on the other binds. So like at the same time or thereabouts where we put 9.3 out, we'll also put out 9.2.4. 9.2.4 will have the bug fixes that are included in 9.3, but it won't have any of the new features. Basically, this is so if people need to breathe twice before going to 9.3, they have a new version of Bind 9.2 with fixes, and then can plan for a proper move to the other major revision. And much to Jim's disappointment, we are also producing a smaller version of Bind 8.4 just some bugs that were around. The other big thing that we did with regards to Bind recently is that we have decided to offer actually commercial support. So far, ISC had only been providing support for Bind by use of the Bind mailing lists, which are open to everyone, but which get replies on a best effort basis. So as we have time, we address the concerns. It also has the advantage that if we don't have time but someone else knows the answers, you can get an answer pretty quickly. And you can discuss about interesting things or anything you just feel about. But that was not enough for some people, so after much thought, we decided to start working and offer support, commercial support. The idea to this is that is not really to provide support to individuals, but actually to the types of organizations that have people dedicated to DNS. So that the kind of questions you'd be asking if you get commercial support would be the more complex ones, so to go. Moving on, dealing with FRUIT, we're continuing with the Anycast deployment. Since the last Pride meeting, we've installed three new nodes in Brisbane, together with APNIC in Monterrey, in Mexico, together with NIC Mexico, and in Lisbon, Portugal, together with the FCCN. We've also reached an agreement with LACNIC for deployment in Latin America. We're going to work to try to cover that continent, which so far has been a bit forgotten, but which has a booming internet population. We have also spent quite some time dealing with updating all these peerings we have all over the world when this bug, or vulnerability if you want to call it so, with TCP was being talked about, and so most of our peerings now have MD5, which is kind of nice, but it was a lot of work. Other work that we are engaging in related to this is trying to increase the analysis capabilities of for trying to spot traffic patterns, how they evolve, what's the current situation. This is work that we'll probably be doing, hopefully be doing together with Keda. I don't know if Casey is here, but I'd actually like to talk to her later. And also on increasing the monitoring capabilities, having about 25 nodes spread out through the world, some in quite remote locations, does make things very interesting, and you have to adapt, basically. To finish off, I just wanted to mention the DNSO arc. This is incident coordination and pattern research and coordination center that ISC launched, and which has a few members. It might be of interest to, I think, quite a few of the implementers and operators of DNS infrastructure. We have kept working on this, and we now have a new system in place to support this, to scale better, to provide better service and more efficient. And we are still trying to show to people that this participation in this would actually be quite interesting to them, probably.
Just to be sure I understand what it is, what ORT means?
The letters?
Yeah.
What was it?
Okay.
I've called it ORC for so long that I think I can't spell it anymore. Susan, help me here. How do you expand ORC? Operations Analysis and Research Center. So it's the components I talked, except I can't come up with the words anymore.
Okay. Are there any questions for you all? No. Well, I have one.
Okay.
And I'm not going to ask somebody who's going to kill by date.
No, I'm not.
I'm going to ask a different one. I might get the same answer, of course. As far as the release of 9.3 is concerned, do you have a time scale in mind for this? And is this going to be dependent on ITF signing off on the revised DNS set drafts?
No, it's not dependent, because the way we chose to deal with the uncertainties on the ITF dates was to put the code in place and make it so that it is disabled unless you actually explicitly enable it, which I think is the route that other implementers have followed.
Okay.
So the idea is, I think, now to have it out, the final version, within the next 2 weeks. Hopefully before May 18th, so that some people feel happier about their lives.
Okay. Thank you very much, Joel. Okay, next up we have Ted Lundgren, who wants to give us a little update on what's happening with NSD. And while this is going on, Dave from Ripe NCC will try and fix something that's going slightly astray with this laptop.
Yeah, I can do it like this.
Okay.
Short update on NSD. We tested in January NSD 2.0 beta against Bind 3. Whatever, 9.3. Whatever, to see the compatibility of DNSSEC. That worked out fine. And in the meantime, it is released, but DNSSEC is still switched off until formally published. IPv6 is enabled by default. In the meantime, two bug fix releases are also released. We have scheduled a new version with new TCP handling code for the end of May, but the most important thing for you is that we want to say that we have a long-term commitment for support, and that means that it is guaranteed at least for 2 years, and it's, in other words, if we say that we stop, then it will still be supported for 2 years to come down. Any questions? If not...
Thank you, Ted. Next up is Suzanne, and I think you might have to hang on to that laptop. Have you got it sorted out, guys? Okay. As some of you might realise, there was a DNSSEC workshop on Monday, which was organised by Suzanne and Steve Crocker. So I believe some people who are in the room were at that particular meeting. Suzanne's going to give an update on what happened there and creating yet another sort of consortium or body for DNSSEC type things. Over to Suzanne.
I need to be able to walk around. Suzanne, Jack, yeah, this is fine. I'm sort of introducing work here by Steve Crocker and Russ Mundy actually organized the workshop. There were many attendees and many people who put hard work into making it happen. So I'm just channeling them at the moment, but they get full credit for the work and the thought. First, a little bit of background on the effort. There has been an effort that's sort of gathering steam to build a roadmap towards DNSSEC deployment. And the motivation there is that there is a DNSSEC specification that has been implemented that people are relatively comfortable with. The documents are in that last stage of there's been consensus that the protocol is done, and the documents are in kind of the last stages of refinement. So we need to be thinking about where to next, because there has been discussion of deployment. It's not as well developed as the specifications. There have been operational discussions among many people who are concerned about getting DNSSEC out there, but they tend to be, you know, barb-offs, and the documentation tends to be, you know, napkins in restaurants and so on. So there's a feeling that it's time to tie it together and start talking about how we're actually going to deploy. Steve Crocker originally looked at this in ICANN's Security and Stability Advisory Committee and decided quite properly, I think, that it was both a bigger topic and a broader community than that committee is looking at, and it's been expanded beyond that initial effort. So the objectives to the roadmap effort, keeping in mind that the specification is necessary but not sufficient to deployment, which we focus so much on specification, sometimes people don't realize that it doesn't really count for the Internet until people are using it. It's an effort to identify the hurdles and the interdependencies around operational deployment and sort of bringing the issues that have been informally discussed to the surface. So the idea is to define a roadmap or a life cycle model and to define a way of measuring progress. How do we know when we've actually succeeded? Or not. There are people that are relatively convinced that DNSSEC is never going to be worth the trouble. It's not going to be useful to the Internet. And frankly, we need to be able to tell if that's what's happening also. Sort of the initial cut at the life cycle model. the stages would be design and specification, which we've largely done. Implementation is beginning to happen, NSD, Unbind, implementing the current spec, productizing these things so they're easy to get to. Education, or if you want to use the word marketing, to inform people that these capabilities are available and they should be considering them. Procurement, installation, training, operational procedures, all of the things that go into making these work, the new specifications turn into things that work in day-to-day reality of the Internet. Deployment is likely to go in phases, where initially nobody uses DNSSEC and hardly anybody even notices when it gets turned off by default. A few sign zones, more as people realize that maybe this is a useful thing for them. Eventually it will become common, and then it will become the expected thing that DNS data will be signed. But these are distinct phases with distinct operational needs. The purpose of the workshop, to start the effort, raising some awareness and getting support from people that might have operational concerns, be interested in operational deployment, but who have been waiting for quite a long time now to say, wait a minute, there's no spec, there's no implementation, wake me up when it's done. I'll wait for the movie. Improve the documentation and awareness of some of the topics people already knew were issues. Find new concerns. And attempt to push formation of groups of people to actually pay attention to these specific issues and start tying them together in a documented and clear kind of a way. And the eventual output will be a roadmap, a rough cut at a deployment roadmap. Specific topics that need to be more formally discussed and bring in more people, more contributions. Key management and DNSSEC. Large set of unsolved problems there, particularly for the root key and the root zone, but even for normal administration. The creation and deployment of trust anchors. How do you know who you're talking to? Who signed this data and what relationship? How do you create a chain back to keys you know? End system tools and procedures. What is a browser going to do with secured data? Training, and there have been privacy considerations, particularly relating to an ability created, not even created necessarily, by some of the DNSSEC records to obtain information about a zone that are not available, that may not be available with an unsecured zone. Specific topics in the workshop, an overview that sort of laid out the body parts, as it were. Some discussion of sequencing and dependencies. There are a number of chicken and egg problems. Where do we start? How do we get these things out there? Issues specific to the root zone and root server operators. Issues for TLD registries and registrars, having mostly to do with things like how do you manage your relationship with your delegations such that DS records can be maintained. Key management. The end system question, what data is an end system going to be getting out of from DNSSEC and how is it useful? Procedures and processes for operational deployment and the IANA considerations for root key management and distribution. Some preliminary conclusions. The privacy issue, we need to, there are varying opinions on the seriousness of it and those need to be clearly laid out. And if there's a problem that needs to be resolved, that is an important issue for moving forward. Server side, the specification looks to be reasonably complete. The implementations are working. That work seems to be in a reasonable state of completeness, except for some questions about how do you manage DNSSEC data for very large zones, and is that worth doing for particular operators. The largest areas of open questions seem to be about end systems, getting applications to use DNSSEC data and conventions for how, resolver behavior, particularly for regarding failures. Is this a one bit, yes, your DNSSEC data validated, no, it didn't, kind of thing, or will applications find it useful to have more detail? And a great deal of operational details to work out that are outside of protocol, but will be critical to have conventions and expectations about. In addition, there's sort of the finding that needs to be made explicit that there need to be training materials, there need to be BCPs for policies for resolver behavior, and what do you do with DNSSEC data, because for the most part, most operators and users won't have an independent sense of what's useful, what's good, what kinds of policies can shoot you in the foot. The DNS is already very, very tolerant to misconfiguration, carelessness, participating in a world where DNSSEC is part of what you're expecting is a little bit more brittle, a little bit more dangerous. It's a little easier to shoot yourself in the foot. And people need to be warned that they are taking some risks that they might not necessarily have thought about. Next steps. There will be another meeting, similar agenda, in conjunction with NANOG in San Francisco on May 23rd. The outcome of that is expected to be gathering some of the new material together, naming a steering group, beginning to document the roadmap, and the pieces of that have to be the sequence of steps that are necessary, what new risks might be coming up, particularly for maintainers and administrators, and how are we going to know when we're done. The URL here for anyone who's interested in following that work, particularly anybody who's interested in participating. There needs to be more operational experience, more clue about what it actually takes to get the stuff out there. So go take a look, and if you're interested in participating, there's a mailing list, and looking forward to hearing from you. And that's all I got. One microphone? Selling? Giving away?
Yeah, Peter Koch. You mentioned that zone walking mm-hmm. problem, which has been on the table for quite some time. Mm-hmm. Was there any prospective solution discussed? Any solution discussed apart from declaring that a non-problem?
Not yet, and frankly, I would hope that a couple of the other folks that attended the meeting would also comment on this. But the stage we're at right now with this particular effort is more identifying issues and attempting to sort how serious they are and what kind of attention they need. I don't think anybody said it's a non-problem. Well, nobody in this meeting was saying it's a non-problem. There are several points of view about how serious it is and what kinds of solutions might be needed or attention might be needed, and I believe at this point we're just documenting that and attempting to assess the feeling of the community about how serious it is and what needs to be done.
So what do you think might it turn out to be a serious deployment obstacle?
Olaf looks like he wants to comment, but if I could first, and then you. I personally think that there is a problem because there hasn't been an adequate answer. I don't know if there's enough of a problem that it should be an obstacle to deployment. Should is such a hypothetical thing, though. What the real issue is there's perceived to be a problem, and that perception has not been adequately answered yet, that either there's a solution to it or it's a non-problem. And to the extent that people think it's a problem, it is, and that's a deployment obstacle and needs to be addressed.
Yes, which could be addressed by A, education, or B, a protocol change, which makes Olaf jump at me now.
Microphone.
Yeah, Olaf, I yield.
A protocol change at this point in time would mean that The working group needs to go back to the drawing board again. There is probably no way to introduce a protocol change that is backwards compatible with what is on the table now. A protocol change would then mean delay, probably of a year. And my biggest fear is that then the stakeholders that are now putting work into making the protocol work run away. And that's a personal fear. I don't know if that happens, but the solutions that have been proposed previously, as far as I understand, did not work. But people claim they can be made to work. So technically, there might be solutions. I think if it goes for deployment, we're probably better off in the other camp in that essentially explains, teaches. I don't have the solution.
Yeah, I think the feeling so far as I can tell, is that there are some issues that can be resolved or mitigated without protocol change, but it does need attention.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, thank you, Suzanne. Next up, we have Måns Nielsen. And whenever Måns comes to give presentations to the UNS Working Group, it seems to be a tradition that he has that the title of his talk bears no resemblance to the content we get on the day. And I think Måns has continued with that noble tradition. So the actual, I saw the copy of the slides that he sent up. It's moving servers, IPv6, and stuff. So that's what we're going to get from Måns right now.
Oh, Windows. Yeah, I know. It's on its way. Full screen.
You can't do... No. Back. Where is it, Man Nelson? You have to save it. Down too hard, it thinks you clicked on it. Where's rotate gone? Sure, where is rotate?
It's in the window. You. Right at you.
Yep.
Counterclockwise.
Yep. And then it's control levels.
Wow. Oh, so, yes. As Jim said, the content and topics of my talks tend to vary from acceptance until deliverance. And there are a number of reasons for this. Most of them is connected with the fact that not always things that I'm going to talk about go as I suspect that they would. Anyway, so I'm going to talk about some observations that I've made during move of a TLD server, query load, and other stuff. Also, I'm going to talk about some B6 experience, some detailed thinking, and I'm going to praise a bit of some software. So, this is basically what I just said. In SC, we have a setup, a number of name-compressed servers, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and H, .ns.sc. They're provided by four different organizations. KTH NOC, which I represent, is one of them. The others are Telia and NetNode and UUNet. Together, as an aggregate, these servers are distributed mostly inside Sweden. There's one outside, that being the UUNet box. Most of them run bind. up to a couple of months ago, all of them ran Bind. And we went into this trying to effect a change in that for a number of reasons. Inside Sunet, we've had for a very long time two boxes, one of which was recursing, oh horror. Both of them were, as I said, running Bind. We wanted to get rid of recursion and interference by other zones. For instance, if you run Bind 8 and have a very large zone, the server would stop answering while reloading the large zone, which is sort of irritating. It becomes even painful when you've got SLAs to fill. And, of course, we wanted IPv6, and the old platform didn't support it, and it was sort of painful to get it rolling on the old boxes. We chose to implement by moving out into separate boxes, which is sort of us hanging on to a trend that's been started by NetNode and Telia, who have been doing this for some time with dedicated boxes and agreements and all this stuff fancied by people in wearing ties. We choose, in contrast to the other DNS operators, to use NSD. Because since we're building dedicated boxes with no recursion and pretty small setups, we felt that it would be a safe bet to go with NSD. And the current setup, as of a couple of weeks ago, is one box completely dedicated to SE. There is only one zone on it. One is shared with a few infrastructure zones and placed in another town, in a safe facility. And just at the moment, this is partly the reason for the change in title and stuff, is that we're in mid-transition. We're taking out one of the old boxes from the SE zone, but not from the root. This is due to the usual IANA delay. And by just redelegating in zone, we see an interesting shift in query patterns. So far, this is all V4. And the red line is the old box, FNSSE. The green line over in the right-hand corner is the new box, the new F. And around on the late in the 28th, we took it out of the zone. So this is what happens when you only have delegation. Of course, the old box still is configured with SE. So this is what happens when you're waiting for IANA. Sort of. I don't intend to blame IANA here, but that's not my point. But this is what happens, actually. So we see a rather large delta in query load. But there is a definite decrease in amount of queries processed by the old box. My hope was to show you a longer graph with time-wise longer graph with the shift in the delegation in the root too, but that hasn't happened yet, for which I apologize. Well, performance. This is good, I think. 13,000 queries per second, one box, NSD 2.02. And it's not the newest box. This is an old Alpha DS20 running NetBSD. I think it's impressive. I would wholeheartedly recommend NSD to anyone doing serious DNS name serving. It's a very potent piece of software. V6, we have in-zone quad A records for our two servers in Sunet, operated by KTHNOC. IPv6 traffic isn't very much. I measured since yesterday afternoon, and I saw something 0.6 queries per second on an average since overnight, since yesterday afternoon until tomorrow, or until today, 9 o'clock. In terms of DNS message size, we've calculated there is room for perhaps two more Quad A records. We do see a lot of usage. If 0.6 queries per second is a lot of usage, but there are queries, and they don't come from places you would expect except from Patrick, who is asking a lot of questions. But we do see queries about things you wouldn't expect. So there is apparently a base of boxes that do Quad A queries first, and they usually do them over V6 as well. This is good. It actually might happen, this V6 thing. We're also playing with increasing the TTL and decreasing the TTL. We just went up to 2 days from 1 day for the apex. The delegations are still at 1 day, but the zone apex is at 2 days just to take some load off the root service. I don't think it's measurable. But we're also taking the negative cache time down to 2 hours to get people that are in a pinch and have done their update work wrongly, to get them a more speedy update on service. Of course, this is a trade-off. If you lower the negative cache TTL too far, you will have an increased load on your service. But on the other hand, the runway boxes that make up for most of the load usually don't care about negative cache. They don't have that concept. So all the well-behaved get better answers. In the future, NetBSD 2.0, because we like it. And as always, in 6 months, we'll have DNSSEC. And V6 glue in root zone. Any time now?
6 months.
6 months? Actually, I see V6 packets. Can we say 3 months instead? Any questions?
Okay. Does anyone have any questions for Mons? Doug?
Hi, Doug Barton, General Manager of IANA. So the good news, we are working on the V6 glue and root issue. It got stalled at the board level for reasons that I won't bore you guys with, but I'm currently working on a paper to unstick that, and we anticipate that it will be covered in the May board meeting. So hopefully we'll be able to see that issue moving forward in late May or early June. The other thing I had was a question. You mentioned a couple times the delay caused by IANA, which obviously is a concern to me. So the first question is, how long ago did you submit the request to change the name service trustee?
I don't think it's been submitted yet.
Ooh.
Okay, so
we were anticipating a delay of something between 2 and 7 days.
I'd say 2 days is probably reasonable. That's usually about how long it takes us to test the name servers and then get the request approved by DOC and then get the thing actually edited by VeriSign. So unfortunately, there's some parts of that process that we don't have control over, but I will kindly accept your apology for not being prescient, and as soon as we get your request, we'll be happy to process it promptly. Thank you.
There is a fair amount of bureaucracy on our side, too, which probably contributes to the delay.
Yeah. Mons, could you give me that 100 euros I didn't give you? Any other questions for Mons? Okay, thanks very much. Next up was supposed to be Bill Banning, and we've had a hunt for him and we can't find him. So I think he has gone somewhere more important, although where other places I don't know. I got mail from him earlier this morning saying, here's the presentation, here's the slides, and by the way, I'm not coming to the group. And I thought this was just Bill being Bill and being facetious, and I said he wasn't coming to the group, as he says, just to sort of kind of increase my blood pressure and anxiety levels, because Bill does that from time to time. So I just assumed this was a joke on his part and didn't consider it any further, but obviously this time he was serious, or at least not, maybe serious, but unfortunately he's not here. So unfortunately we're not going to have Bill's presentation on his survey results. However, happily, we have a substitute. As some of you know, that was discussed at the last meeting, Peter has been doing a survey of name server deployments and things in Germany, and Peter had agreed he would give a short presentation on his work, and we'd be able to do contrast and comparisons between his survey results and Bill's survey results and the methodologies. Over to Peter. So this thing means we're finishing time for lunch for a change.
Well, a free Windows course for me. That's
This is the mouse, and this is
perfect. Okay. So while I refuse to be a substitute for Bill Manning, I just give that presentation and bore you a bit longer than I planned. So I guess in January we had the presentation from Roy showing us the fingerprinting tool FPDNS, which can be used to remotely ask a name server for its version without prior written consent of the operator. And that is what I did. So since we're going into the lunch break, I'll present you the menu. For starters, when and what did I do? What did I measure? And for the main course, of course, the results and the statistics and maybe the lies you can dedicate from that, derive from that, sorry. And finally, I'll also have a dessert for you, some oddities and strange things I found during the survey. So, to start with, the DE name servers were fingerprinted. That is not the name servers serving the top-level zone, but all name servers serving zones within the DE top-level domain. You may know the DE top-level domain is the second largest TLD in the world, the largest CC TLD with roughly, I guess, 7 million. Is that correct, Andreas? 7 million domains in DE and maybe roughly 6 million delegations. So as I said, I used the FPDNS tool provided by Roy Ahrens and Jakob Schlüter. Thanks for doing the work. The basis was the data collected during the host count, you know, the RIPE DNS host count project, which recursively walks down the DNS tree once a month and collects data and counts host. So I took the data collected during the March host count, which ran end of March, start of April. It's rather fresh. Well, roughly on my way here to Amsterdam, the survey was started. And it took, well, half a day to query all the servers. What to keep in mind is that those servers are the servers for the DE zones or subzones of DE. They are not necessarily located within DE. That means they are not necessarily operated within Germany or have a name ending in DE anyway. So during the data collection, there were 55,000 servers identified. To start with, as I said, there are 6 million delegated domains, which ends up in, say, 12 or 13 million NS records, which then were unique and a bit massaged. So 55,000 different servers were identified. And during the survey, I received answers from roughly half of them, that is 25,500 IP addresses, which may or may not reflect different servers. Some servers are multi-homed. Many are multi-named, which is we have many, many names pointing to the very same IP address, and, of course, those servers hopefully give the same results, but more on that later.
Some of the servers, of course, don't even exist because the delegations are stale. That means the NS record points to names which don't resolve or don't resolve to A records. By the way, this is IPv4 only for the moment. And others have bogus addresses, that is, they are using IRC 1918 space or some other weird IP addresses. So this should explain the difference between the 55,000 and 25,500. Of course, some systems just are non-responsive. In the survey, I found 19 different products used in altogether 38 versions. FPDNS is capable of telling apart, for example, different versions of bind, bind 8.1, bind 8.2, da-da-da, and so on and so forth. And for the following slides, I collapsed all versions of one product altogether. That means you will see only bind 8 and not split up between the different sub-versions of bind 8. And, of course, the charts can only take into account the servers that were responsive. There was no guessing or estimate for the rest of it. So this is the distribution servers by number. That is, every server is treated equally and counts for one. Now you see, and this is for the joy of Jim and everyone else who is a fan of Bind 9, you see that more than half of the servers identified, or at least half of, more than half of the servers which answered, are running Bind 9. By the way, I have to apologize for the two-digit fraction, which is not good statistics, but just my me being unfamiliar with the pie chart tool. So roughly 30% still run bind 8, which is this salmon-colored piece of pie, and 2.24, or say 2%, run bind 4. Yeah, they are still out there. And this may be interesting. There are several other products. I said 19 in total. I didn't split for the rarely used ones. But, for example, DJB DNS, Tiny DNS, roughly 6% of the servers run Tiny DNS. Again, roughly 6% run Microsoft DNS, any version of it, and around about 1% Power DNS. We had a presentation of Power DNS in January too. And the rest is again 1% of all the servers. But then, servers by delegation, which means I took into account the number of zones actually covered by particular servers, and now we have a somehow weighted result. That means the percentage of servers multiplied by zones covered by bind 9 is, as I promised or predicted in January, is really going down to approximately 17%. And then bind 8 wins with more than two-thirds. So that is taking a server, multiplying that with the number of zones covered by that server, and you'll have this result. The tiny DNS fraction is almost stable. We have a small decrease on the Microsoft side, and if you compare that to the previous one, the Power DNS part has grown from 1 to 3%, which means that those folks, there are some folks running Power DNS, but obviously they are serving lots of zones, so they are represented with 3% in this pie chart. The good news is that the fraction for bind 9 is going down to below 1%. So those folks still running bind, bind 4, of course. Those folks running bind 4 really cover only a few zones. Okay, so this is not the end. I have another one. This is servers by what I call weighted delegation. That means I've taken into account how many servers there are per zone. And now you may have one NSD, one tiny DNS, and say two bind 8 for one zone. So bind 8 received for that zone, 50%, that is 0.5, and the others received a weight of 0.25. And this is, again, slightly different from the previous one. You see that bind 8 raises above 70%. And that means now folks running bind 8 are probably then running only bind 8 to cover their zones. Okay? And again, tiny DNS is rather stable, which probably means the same thing, that people running tiny DNS, DJB DNS, don't trust anyone else and are just running two servers serving their zones with both DJB DNS software. So putting it all together, you see the difference. The inner ring, or the upper part of the stable pi, is the first slide. Bind 9 has a very large market share, over 50%, but zones covered is this one, and then the weighted zone. There's no, almost no difference for bind 4 and the Microsoft and the PowerDNS stuff, but there's a large difference in bind 8 versus bind 9, meaning that there are lots of providers, obviously, or larger providers, which still use bind 8 and have not yet switched to bind 9. Okay, so I could now continue and present any other angle, view angle on the data to make anyone happy, like maybe we find some reason to have a large market share for PowerDNS or something. I will not do that. But, well, there are some drawbacks. The third chart, the weighted delegation thing, still treated all zones equally, not taking into account how many queries for that zone really are underway. And you can imagine that, for example, Microsoft.de will receive many, many more queries than I don't know what Kinderbücher.de, right, exactly. Well, this is one of the measurements which are influenced by telling that it's not very popular. Okay, but for example, such kind of domains. So which ones of the domains are really used? If we're interested in deploying new stuff, new protocol features, and that's part of the motivation for doing those surveys anyway, it is probably important to take into account the, yeah, say, usage patterns, whatever that means, the load that is produced by queries for those zones. What we really would need to know is the query distribution, which, of course, we can't measure from the outside. That would have to be measured at some busy resolvers, probably located at large ISPs or other occasions. The other question is, isn't the resolver software at least as important to decide whether or not a given feature is successfully deployed, or whether to decide what to do about, say, backward compatibility issues? And maybe we could do this. We could measure the resolver software at the server side. I'm not too sure. Maybe someone has an idea. The server software measuring is just by, you may remember, sending weird queries and interpreting the responses. If we measure on the server side, we just have the queries and can't influence them. We could send bogus responses and look what the what the resolvers would do with that, but I guess most of you would be reluctant to donate their production system domains for such kind of research, maybe on April Fool's Day or something. Okay, so the challenge that I guess remains is finding out at what version and what facility what capabilities the resolvers out there in the green do have. So, and as promised, now for the dessert. What I could also see is that 64% of all the name servers were offering recursive service. That is not, well, it's not a big surprise, but it's also not really good news. It's bad news. Again, what I didn't do for this slide, we could then check and weigh this and multiply this by the number of zones covered, and that picture wouldn't be too bad because the large providers serving hundreds of thousands of zones have configured their servers not to run or not to offer recursive service, but still there's a large fraction of servers obviously vulnerable to certain kinds of attack. Some servers are both multi-homed and multi-named, that is, many names pointing to different IP addresses, but still being run on a single system, which you can find out by, abusing the recursive service and querying for a name, which then comes into the cache, and then querying for that name on a different IP address where you suspect it's the same system, and then compare the TTLs. So some of them are both multi-homed and multi-named, which has influences on the statistics, but I didn't do any very deep research on that. Okay, for the funny things, the topmost multi-home name server had 201 IP addresses for a single name server, which may or may not have funny side effects. Luckily, that server is only delegated one single zone within DNA. Some servers seem to suffer from what I would like to call split personality. That is, lots of servers are multi-named, that is, different names leading to the same IP address. And in that case, they were queried for every name because in advance I don't know they share the IP address. And one of the queries resulted in saying it's bind 8.1 final release, and others said it's bind 8.2.2 patch level 3. So this is not to blame Roy or Jakob. There's some work still to do on the fingerprinting tool because obviously there are side effects which lead to problems depending on where in that decision tree we actually are. Some other observations. PowerDNS, for example, one of the things the FPDNS tool is, it sends notify messages for the root zone to the target server and then interprets the response. PowerDNS always follows up with an SOA query for the root. Yeah, it does, and I haven't tried offering them a root. Actually, the system I run the survey from actually has a root then, but there were no zone transfer attempts after that, just the SOA. Another thing the FPDNS does is it sends notifies for a random name for given values of random, which means that JJJJJ is hard-coded in the script. And, at least one server now regularly tries to load the JJJJJ zone by AXFR from that system I ran the survey of. Don't know whether someone noticed that in the logs and configured it manually or what kind of strange software might be underway there. And then, of course, there are a couple of tracks left by the fingerprinting tool. Like people see those notify messages for this is not our zone or any other queries, strange queries showing up. And every once in a while, someone sends a message and says, hey, what are you doing there sending notify packets for JJJJ? The best one I saw was an automated response by an intrusion detection system. On another occasion where I had this more invasive survey querying for version.bind, which I didn't do in this one, and that sent a mail message and complained and so on and so forth, which I think is a very interesting opportunity for denial of service attacks, not on the IDS, but with an IDS as an amplifier, and, well, maybe a business opportunity. Okay, so that's finally it. Any questions, comments?
Are there any questions for Peter? No. Well, I have one.
Go ahead.
I always seem to be asking questions. The number of people you said, or number of servers that are running Bind 8, have you tried to get any kind of... I realise all you've done is done the surveys, Peter, but have you tried to find out the motivations for the people that have got these Bind 8 servers that have got large numbers of zones on them to find out why they haven't upgraded to Bind 9?
Well, not... not really. I've talked to some of them. You may imagine, well, I won't name names and I won't show the absolute figures because the access to the DE zone is on non-disclosure basis and so on and so forth, and DE people are sitting out there. Anyway, they would trust me. So you can imagine that the Bind 8 people are maybe larger providers. And what I've heard is the concern about load. My personal concern is that Bind 9 up to and including 9.2 has a protocol problem when it comes to no error, no data responses, where it says NX domain, which is plain wrong, and which I was told is fixed in 9.3. So maybe that's... maybe 9.3 will change these gaps.
Okay, thank you. No other questions? Okay, let's move on to last item on our agenda, which is any other business. And at this point, I would like to ask if there's anyone in the room that has any other business. No one's got a problem with anything. Okay, there is one item of any other business which I have to announce, is that Patrick Falstrom has decided to resign as co-chair of the DNS Working Group. And I'd like to thank Patrick for all his efforts over his tenure in that capacity as co-chair. Thank you very much. Patrick has done this because of what's going to be happening after lunch. We have an ENAM BOF with a view to creating an ENAM working group. And I think Patrick is perhaps going to have a role in that. So he's not going away, he's maybe just changing his hat. So I'd like to say thank you for Patrick for that. Also, this means now that we have at least a vacancy for another co-chair. So if there's anyone here who would like to assist in the running of the DNS working group at subsequent night meetings, we will welcome you with open arms. So if anyone's interested, please come forward. Not necessarily right now, but at any point in the future, we'll be glad to hear from you. Thank you very much, and now we can go and get to lunch early for a change. Oh, and thanks to all the speakers today.
Thank you. Change the setting in Adobe.
Okay, I'll take it back to this one.
Well, depending on who you design that.